Hi, everybody. This is Armand Demel.
And this is Roberta Maria Atti.
Here with you with The Positive Mind. WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Hey, Roberta. Welcome back.
Thank you, Armand. It's nice to be back.
Are you happy?
What's happy, Armand?
You know, feeling good.
Feeling good right now or all the time?
Well, I don't know, Roberta. You know, just, are you happy?
I don't know what happy is anymore.
Well, why are you so confused?
Because I've been doing a lot of reading, you know, and it seems like finally the researchers that study neuroscience are paying attention to happiness. It seems like there's been a lot of time spent on the negative emotions as far as the research is concerned, you know, sadness and grief and anger and all of those. Finally, someone is paying attention to the brain when it's happy.
Mm. Yeah.
And it's very interesting. And it's showing that happiness indeed has a chemical configuration in the brain that is detectable through a functional MRI.
And it's also, I guess, you can measure hormones too, can't you?
You can measure anything through a functional MRI because it gives you an image of the brain in motion.
So through neuroscience, we're now recently looking at the chemistry and the effect, not only the chemistry, of happiness and what is happiness. Now, you may not think this is something you need to talk about because happy is just plain happy. But, you know, there's a little cemetery up near Woodstock. One of my favorite places is you go up Woodstock and you take the road going up towards the monastery. There's a cemetery. And the very first gravestone that you see, it's very old, must be from the 1700s. It says, Happy.
Really?
Yeah, the guy's name was Happy. And the Happy family is all buried there.
Oh, Felice.
Yeah,
in Italian, it would be Felice.
The Happy family. So what is happiness? Happiness is a very good point because there are so many theories.
Happiness is activation of the left frontal neocortex.
With a deactivation
of the amygdala and the right frontal neocortex.
That's what happiness is. And none of it should be a song.
Yes.
That's what happiness is. It's an activation of the right neocortex and the prefrontal lobe down mixed with your lowering your amygdala. And that's what happiness is. If you want a copy of that recording, you could send a donation to WBAI. And Roberta and I will sing this song for
Absolutely.
You.
Absolutely.
So, really, let's get into that. If they look at the brain with these incredible new machines, and they get in there, and the neuroscientists look, and they say, oh, now we can see the MRI in motion, functional MRI, not just flat MRI, you know? And we can see hot spots and cool spots. Believe it or not, the part of the brain that is most active when people are the most energetic is the part that is most associated with unhappiness. Well, that makes sense. Because the part of the brain that would be most active if you're under threat, when you're excited, if you're nervous, right? Some of us associate nervousness with happiness, but it's not true.
Well, what the researchers decided to do when they set out to do this work, they thought about, well, who is happy? And they thought of His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And so they wrote to him and said, His Holiness, could we please come and talk to you about happiness? And he said, of course. And so they went all the way to Dharamsala in India, and they spent some time with him, and they did these MRIs of monks, of people who are trained meditators, who are at peace with themselves and experience a sense of happiness and contentment most of the time. And it turns out that these people have a part of the brain that's activated most of the time, and that's the left side in the frontal lobe. And the more upset a person is, the less active that spot is. And the more upset a person is, the more active the amygdala is, which is in the back of the brain. It's in the limbic system, in the brainstem, well, a little bit of above that, but it's in the back of the brain, or the right side of the frontal lobe.
So now this is a very funny thing. The right side of the frontal lobe, I mean, really, Roberta, the frontal lobe of your brain is right in the front of your head.
Yes, exactly.
Right? It's over your eye.
It's over your eye, yes.
Right? So over your
right side.
If the right side is active,
that means you're depressed or upset or sad, grieved. So people who are depressed, who have a habit of being upset, that's where the most activity is in their brains.
And it's a funny thing, because when people are unhappy, they usually slap themselves over the right eye and they go, oy vey.
Maybe that's why.
Maybe that's why. Watch out for that slap. Hit yourself on the other side. You'll feel better.
Yeah, it might work.
Activation of both, it seems, even though we're treating this lightly, it needs the amygdalic area, that whole hippocampus.
Well, the amygdala is a tricky piece, because the amygdala seems to become very active. The more upset we are, the more active it is. But there are people who have it chronically activated, meaning these are people who can't turn off the bad emotions. They can't turn off the sadness, the grief, the fear, etc., etc. So those are people who have a bit of a harder time getting into the left frontal lobe activation.
So there are some people who cannot quiet their brains.
Exactly. This is what's being shown by the research, that it's not a matter of saying to someone, hey, snap out of it already.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, what people think, that you can just snap out of an emotion. Some people are not able to. And it seems that the younger you are, the more difficult it is to snap out of an emotion, because the brain learns to subdue certain emotions. It learns to do that. It's not innate.
There are some people who have the kind of unhappiness that when their amygdala and the right frontal cortex,
right,
we're doing good,
yeah,
are activated. And this could happen when you get very emotionally upset, insulted, somebody hurts you.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I'm sorry, person apologizes. I'm sorry, get over it. And it doesn't, you would expect, oh, I'll just get over it because they apologized. No. For some people, they can't get over it.
Right.
Now, this is important. It doesn't make you more neurotic because you can't get over it. It means that you have that kind of a system. So here's what they did. They studied people's baselines. They tried to get maps of different people's baselines, like where is how much activity is in your brain at that point, you know, and how do we associate that with your feeling good versus feeling bad. And they found when you go outside of your baseline of what you normally feel, you will get more depressed.
Well, what they found was that if someone wins the lottery, and so they're really happy, all of a sudden they have a different pattern in their brains and nervous systems, because, of course, this is an unusual state of happiness, and it activates different parts of the brain that are normally not active. So there's a difference there. But after about a year or so of the winning of the lottery, they would go and they would look at the brain of that individual again and find that it had reset itself more along its regular
its original
state.
Yes, its original baseline.
State. Same thing with people who suffered an accident, who suffered a loss. Let's say someone who had an accident and lost the use of their legs, which is a serious thing. For a period of time, the brain is activated in a pattern that is very different from the normal one. But then eventually it goes back to that original setting. So what this says is that we all have a kind of a thermostat, is the word I'm looking for.
Good word.
Meaning it's a setting that is perhaps genetically set, perhaps depending on the childhood we have had, perhaps depending on a number of factors. We have a setting that is our own individual signature of happiness or the lack thereof, and we tend to go back to that state.
And so if you get moved out of it, you're going to slide back to it.
Right. That's
if something moves you out. Now, there are many, many, many theories about what makes you happy. Many theories. In fact, almost all advertising is based on a promise that that which they are advertising is associated with happiness. If it depends, you know, right. If we're offering it depends, right, it's going to make you happy.
Sure, it's right? going to solve a big problem.
It's going to solve a big problem. And
well, that's called the hedonistic theory, Armand, the one you're describing.
Well, there's quite a few different theories. Let's talk
but
about some of them.
That particular one, the one that promises to make you happy by giving you something that you don't have at the moment, that's called the hedonistic theory.
There are many theories about what happiness and what are the components of happiness. We're going to present to you a couple of them. Hedonism theory makes a claim. It says, when there is more pleasure than pain, you are happy. Nice and simple. Hedonistic belief is, if you have more pleasure than pain, you're happy. When you have more pain than pleasure, you're not happy. This is like Descartes, you know, presenting, I think, therefore I am.
Uh-huh,
you know, this is like the beginning of it.
Cut and dry.
Right, cut and dry. Then comes Hume. You know, then comes the next philosopher right. who says, oh, no, 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 no. Let's go to the desire theory.
Right.
And the desire theory that says we all have goals. If you reach your goals, you're happy. And if you don't reach your goals, you're not happy, regardless of the pleasure or pain. So if you reach your goals, but you've lost your arms and your legs and your husband and your four kids, according to the desire theory, you can make it.
Mm-hmm. That would qualify as happiness. Right. So the happiness in that theory is not necessarily equated with a good feeling. In fact, a person could be miserable and yet be happy because they have achieved something that matters to them more than their own well-being.
Would you equate this with Mozart and Beethoven? And
I would equate this with anyone who has suffered a great deal and who has nonetheless achieved great goals, great, human conquests of the mind and the intellect and the heart, and has done so through struggle. You know, their lives may have been very difficult and they may have had very little enjoyment, and yet they may have composed nine symphonies that make a lot of people feel really good.
But it didn't make them feel good necessarily.
It didn't. No, actually, he didn't even hear it, the nine
right,
symphonies.
Right, absolutely. So it turns out that most happiness, just get this expression, most happiness is a temporary chemical imbalance.
Right.
That the normal state of mind is not happiness. Normal state of mind is the normal state of mind. Happiness is a blip.
Right.
And blips happen in different kinds of ways.
And it has to do with neurotransmitters that are being secreted at higher levels than usual. And so there's more stimulation of certain centers and less stimulation of other centers, but then eventually the brain goes back to its normal state.
So when you meet a friend of yours who you haven't seen in 5 years, and you're somebody who you've competed with in high school, and your friend comes along and says, "Hi, are you happy?" You screw on this face that, you know, and you smile, and you say, "Yes," as if it means I'm in that altered state of happiness all the time. I feel good, like happy, all the time. And what we're beginning to understand is that if you do feel that way, you're crazy.
Or you're lying.
Or you're lying.
You're, you know, pretending. There are some people who pretend to feel good because it's more popular than feeling bad.
But happy is a different than just feeling good, because I feel good most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
But that happy state.
Happy is tricky, because you could be happy because you've taken a lot of a mood-altering substance that's very toxic, like ecstasy. you know, or something like that, that could make you feel really, really good, and you could think you're very happy, but are you really?
Everybody's got the solution for happiness. We were writing down some of the great theories of happiness, but let's go back to the objective list theory.
Okay.
Now, the objective list theory says, if I can make a list out of the things that make me feel good.
Well, if I have the things I need, like if I have a roof over my head, if I have food today, if I'm able to take care of my basic needs, what I consider my necessary things, then I'm happy. But that's tricky because what's necessary for me may be a luxury for someone else, and it may be nothing for another individual. You know, there are people who are used to living in such luxury that for them to live like I do could be equated to deprivation. And yet there are people, and I've seen them with my own eyes, who are so poor.
Like in Angola, in the capital of Luanda.
Like in India, like, you know, some of the people in the world have so little that to someone like that, to have what I have, a car, a home, food every day.
And you're from New Jersey.
I am not from New Jersey, Armand. I am from Bologna.
I can get you to do that every time, can't I? In the New York Times, the description of happiness. It said, dressed in rags, the people in Luanda, the capital of Angola, spent nights in the sandy strip along the bay, their days foraging for food through mounds of garbage. It seems conceivable that their existence, consumed with meeting momentary needs, adventurous roving in gangs, casual sex with little thought about tomorrow, might actually be subjectively happy from either the hedonism or the desire point of view. But if you look at it objectively, from our point of view, how could they possibly be happy? But if their goals are satisfied, their needs are satisfied for one given moment, their experience is happy, and you will actually see joy on the face of the children.
Armand, I know it sounds like a cliche, but I'm going to say it. I mean, I take the train, and I take the train to come into New York because I live in New Jersey. I'm not from New Jersey.
To eat a donut on the train.
And on the train, there are people who are obviously wealthy. You know, you can tell by what they're wearing and what they're reading and all that. Wealthy, relatively speaking, and they look utterly miserable. They look angry, tired, etc. And I spent time with lepers in India, people who have been excluded from society, who don't own anything, who don't know if they're going to eat this day or the next day. And they were laughing all the time. They were laughing at the sun. They were laughing at the rain. They were laughing at themselves. They were laughing at the, you know, whatever. So, okay, it sounds like a cliche, but I think it makes a point for the fact that happiness could have an element of choice as well as an element of spontaneity that is, you know, non-dependent on any of the factors that we consider key to being happy.
I mean, if I would ask everybody in the audience out there, what makes a person happy? Everybody would come up with their own idea. And you know, Roberta, it's so tempting to say money doesn't make you happy. But you know, it's like, it's very hard for me to look at this objectively and to say from where I stand, you know, I don't really know what's going to make anybody happy. That's not what I could promise. A person comes to me for treatment because they're unhappy. I'm not going to make them happy, but I'm going to get them from being unhappy. See, I'm going to work at what's helping them in the miserable place.
Right.
But the absence of unhappiness doesn't necessarily mean happy. It could mean peace. Some people will sell you the following things. What are the items that you buy and you're promised happiness? Religion. Big deal. If you listen to Roberta Atti last Thursday morning at 8 o'clock, at 6 o'clock in the morning,
yeah,
you made a case for...
That was a fun time. That was a fun time to do that show. I made a case for the missing of the female deity, but that's a whole other story. But anyway, religion can make a person feel good, sure. I mean, who
but,
said
but
it's
the ones who
the
sell
opium
religion,
of the masses? Who
the ones
Marx?
Who sell the religion say, if you buy religion, meaning if you become, you're going to be happy.
Forever.
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 Right?
Right.
So I had this friend, George, who went into the monastery because he thought, well, how, I'll become a monk.
Mm-hmm.
And he went into the monastery and he stayed there for 12 years in a monastery, never saying a word or rarely saying mm-hmm. a word. He says, I was no happier. You know, he got out and then he got a job in Wall Street.
And then was he happy?
No, he wasn't happy then either. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, he was a good-spirited guy.
Well,
but he said it was the promise of God did not work. Because when you got in touch with that part of yourself, it didn't necessarily work. So religion is one. Sometimes sex. People say sex will make you happy. So they tell husbands and wives, if you're having a good romantic relationship where you're both having a lot of sex, you're going to be happy with each other.
Well, look at Romeo and Juliet. Were they happy?
They didn't have much sex.
But, I mean, you know, you talk about romantic love here, whether it involves the sexual encounter or not. I don't think that's the point. The point is,
does love make you happy?
If people are in love romantically, does that make them happy?
Well,
obviously
I think some of the, well, some of the research you and I have been doing recently talked about the initial phase of a romantic relationship and with the chemistry. The activation of the dopamine in the brain
right.
gives you a feeling of feeling elated.
But see, this is where, Armand, I get into my questioning, because I could understand how Romeo and Juliet could be really, really secreting a lot of dopamine and norepinephrine.
All
and
over the stage.
All over the place.
Because they didn't exist. You know, this is written. This is a play.
But I mean, you know, the metaphor for that kind of love. Okay, so Romeo and Juliet with all of this norepinephrine, dopamine, and that gives a sense of euphoria. But is that happiness? I think euphoria is different from
well, you
from
see,
happiness.
I'm not gonna make a claim, Roberta. I know what you're saying, but everybody thinks they have a definition. Euphoria is different, joy is different, bliss is different, God is different. I don't know. I don't even know, you know, I mean, what the real description of love is. But we do know that love is one of the things that you are sold. That's why they sell you Valentine's cards. And they say if you have love, you'll be happy. If you have sex, you'll be happy. If you have love plus sex, you'll be happy. If you have love plus sex plus religion, you'll be confused. Then you could have sex with orgasm or without orgasm. Because according to the Kundalini, no, not the Kundalini, according to...
Tantra?
Tantric yoga, mm-hmm. right? Sex without orgasm leads to happiness.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's another group who says, no, wait, what are you talking about? You know, sex without orgasm gives you a headache. Meditation. Meditation is often thought of as the path to happiness, and not so far from what we've been studying about the brain waves, because if you could quiet the active part of your brain, if you could, you might feel happier if that activity in your brain is a chronic angst to you. You know, so like if you're obsessing all the time and you can quiet your obsessions, you know, you're going to feel better.
Mm-hmm.
So they talk about meditation. Now I want to ask you about one, Roberta. Health. Everybody says, as long as you got your health.
Mm.
Right? So therefore, you are a health expert. I mean, if there's ever been a health expert, this is I'm now asking you, the pro. You've seen healthy people and you've seen not healthy people. So you have got to say to me, since you sell health, and as of now, I know you're even producing some of your own nutrients that are really fantastic.
Thank you.
You know, I just tried one earlier today, and I felt awake.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But now, therefore, does health make you happy?
Armand, I have to say that I used to believe that that was the case, and I no longer do.
Oh, no. Mm. Oh, no.
Because I've met people who would be considered the healthiest from all standards and all perspectives, and objectively and subjectively were not happy.
Oh, if you listen to the health gurus. If you listen to the health gurus real closely, if you listen to the ones who are the vitamin nutrition people who, you know, have these programs. And
could only be happy if you're healthy, right? That's the message.
That's their message. But if you listen closely to their voices, the ones who are preaching it, they're very tense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, there are certain ones out there who are.
Well, Armand, I feel that these people have an expectation of perfection, and so they expect themselves to excel at health, and that unless one is able to bring oneself to that level, one does not have the right to be happy. And I think people have the right to be happy when they're dying. They have the right to be happy when they're the sickest. They have the right to be happy whenever they exist. They have a right to
Well,
be
you've
happy.
Seen some of the sickest.
Right.
And you've seen some of the unhealthiest.
Right.
Right? And then you've seen the top healthiest.
Yes, I have.
Who tends to be happier?
The less healthy.
Oh, no.
I'm sorry to say, Armand.
No.
I'm telling you the truth.
I'm going back to McDonald's. No.
It's not a matter of, you know, it's not so
I
much
know
that,
it's true.
You know
I know
what
you're
I'm saying?
Saying.
It's,
sure.
It's like the people who are the healthier, the happier are the people who are not so worried about their health and about how long they're going to live and about how good they're going to look.
And perfectionism. And
that's the truth. The people don't worry about their wrinkles and about their little beer bellies and about the fact that, you know, maybe tomorrow the sky is going to fall. So what?
I know some of the finest people in the world are in New Jersey, especially southern New Jersey. So I know some
it's
really
true.
Fine,
I actually
wonderful,
too.
Wonderful people.
Yes.
You know, I mean, I've got
it's true.
Ginger and just some of the people who are the greatest.
And
the,
I love New
thank
Jersey.
Thank you, by the way. Thank you, Ginger, for your gift.
Thank you.
But truthfully, are they happier in New Jersey?
Than
or,
in New York?
Or in Bologna?
Or in Bologna. I would say Bologna. But maybe I'm biased on that one, Armand. I mean, you're asking a lot out of me.
All right. Let's talk about money.
Okay.
Doesn't money make you happy?
You know, I'd like to see if it would make me happy for once. I would like to try. Because everybody says it doesn't make you happy. I'd like to try and see, because you never know. Maybe
well,
I could
you do
find
know
a way.
They studied these lottery winners.
Right, and it seemed actually, Armand, the amazing thing is that actually, it turns out that people who win the lottery often end up in trouble, because this money that comes in suddenly is such a shock, and it alters their lives to such an extent that they lose a sense of who they are, and then a couple of years later, they're depressed because they lost it all, and they, you know, whatever. It's a strange thing.
Yeah, it's kind of funny picking your head up. I know a man who had very little money, and he made $4 million in the stock market. $4 million by owning a thing called options. And then, from nothing to $4 million, I mean, he had like about $20,000, turned it into $4 million. And then he went back from $4 million all the way down to $1 million. He committed suicide.
Yeah. See that?
He committed suicide because he lost $3 million, but he had $1 million more than
right.
he ever had. Okay, so if not money, how about power? How being able to tell everybody to do what you want them to do, and they listen to you, and your kids go to sleep when you say go to sleep, and your parents leave you alone, and you have power? No, that may not do it. Other people say freedom makes you happy.
Well, that's one I kind of like.
Yeah, of course you do. Mm. Right? But you've never been a bird to be tethered.
A what?
Well, we're going to have to talk about that. And there's also the theory about hope.
Yeah,
that if you don't have hope, you can't be happy.
Right.
You know? But I'm not so sure if any of this is true. So we're going to get back to a little more of the study of this. And we're going to explain to you after the break why the Swiss are significantly happier than the Bulgarians.
That's very important.
And why people at 42 years old tend to be happier than everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be back with you in a short while. This is Armando Mill with Roberta Maria Atti. Back with you soon, my friends.
Hi, this is Danny Glover. You're tuned in to WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
TalkBack is your gathering place for the free and fair exchange of information and ideas heard here Monday through Thursday from 3 until 5 in the afternoon. I'm Hugh Hamilton. Join me as we explore the issues and events making news across the nation and around the world with expert guests, insightful analysis, and, of course, your comments, questions, and observations. That's TalkBack right here on WBAI New York.
Hey, listen, my friends, if there's somebody out there today who recorded this program and did a good recording of it, we need to get a copy of the recording as you made it, because we had a little interference on our side with the recording. So any of my friends out there who are recording today's program, please get me a copy of it. Isn't that amazing? And that'll make me happy. Armando Mill here with Roberta Maria Atti. If you just tuned in, we're talking about the nature of happiness and what makes you happy. You know, some people, I think it's different, Roberta, for everybody. See, here's what I believe. This is a funny thing. The more we learn from neuroscience, the more validation we get of our original theories, the original concepts. Money won't make you happy. Love will make you happy. Love won't make you happy. Who knows? Who knows? But why are the Swiss happier than the Bulgarians? Now, this is done with some objective testing, And in the objective testing, more people who are Swiss tended to say they were happier than more people who are Bulgarian. Now, does that mean the Bulgarian political situation is so bad that it casts a pall on the attitude of people? Do you think it's from that? Do you think the Swiss being a neutral country and more intellectual? Or do you think because the Swiss clean up their streets?
See, I think it has to do with the freedom, with the level of freedom that the Swiss experiences. The Swiss are free to do whatever they want to do, not so for the Bulgarians.
I think it's the cheese. Who ever heard of Bulgarian cheese?
Yeah, no
it's
cheese
Swiss
in Bulgaria.
Cheese, right?
Yeah.
You know, so maybe, I mean, maybe
it's true.
But that's
my theory.
Sure. But you see, now each of us are going to choose a theory based on our personal needs. So when someone says to someone, good sex will make you happy, they're really saying, good sex makes me happy. When they're saying, having a good friend will make you happy, they're saying, good friends make me happy. And some people don't understand that what makes one person happy does not make another person happy. Let's take a look at the Enneagram for a moment and just personality structures, preferences, fixations. This is something that the Sufis developed many, many years ago. And the Sufis, you know, want to say who the Sufis were?
Excuse me?
The Sufis?
Yeah, the Sufi, right.
Ancient religious group from
Islamic roots. Yes.
Smart people.
They are the mystics of Islam.
And some of the smartest as far as figuring things out and putting things in order. You know what I mean? Not just mystics.
Very, very metaphysical. Very, very, and there's a lot of esoteric knowledge and wisdom in the Sufi tradition, as well as a lot of poetry and beauty and art. And dance.
Yeah, the most famous poet.
Rumi.
Rumi, R-U-M-I. And, you know, Sufi books downtown.
That's where I do my workshops.
That's where you do your workshops.
Right.
Okay, so the Sufis came up with this concept that there are nine, they wanted to figure out how can they get people to worship better or attend to their religion better, and they came up with a study, well, you know, we figured one thing out. It isn't just one person. You can't just say everybody will be happy if you give them pie, a piece of pie. I'm going to say pie because yesterday was Pie Day, as you know, Roberta.
Mm-hmm.
Very important day.
Yes, very important.
So if you give everybody a piece of pie, are they going to all be happy? Well, it's a question. Some people don't eat pie. So the Sufis went to figure how many different types of people could we estimate or guess at? And they came up with nine types. Now, I'm going to tell you the nine types, just in case you're not familiar with this. And here, this is related to happiness. It seems that whatever your fixation means, which means the focus of your attention, of your life, in it, there are nine different types of people who have nine different focuses of attention. The first type is called the perfectionist. And the perfectionist's focus of attention is making things perfect. They like order, they like structure, they like things to be neat. Now, some of you know perfectionists. You know a perfectionist, you've seen them, you know. They're always picky, they're always telling you what to do, they're always telling you what vitamins to eat and what, you know, they tend to be preachers and they're always trying to make perfect. When do they get happy? When they see perfection. So, and they're rarely happy, by the way, personally rarely happy. Perfectionists are rarely ever happy because they're always finding something else imperfect. But the focus of their attention is perfection. So that's one. Another type is the compulsive giver. Now, the compulsive giver is a personality type that always feels good only if the other person is happy, if they can give to somebody and that somebody will receive it. They give in an effort to get love back. But, you know, if you're one of these people, you're just a person who loves to serve people. And you love to serve them, and you love to take care of them. And if you could find somebody who is happy because you took care of them, then you're happy. So now notice the person who is the second one is not like the person who's the perfectionist, because the perfectionist, they don't care about serving people. They want to make people perfect. The second one wants to serve people. The third type is the image-driven personality, and this is a person who is only considered, feels happy when their image of themselves, especially their work, is applauded, lauded, or recognized. So if you see somebody of this personality type and they have success at work or they get a good note or a promotion from the boss, they're very happy. And then we have the romantic. The romantic is the deep person who tends in general to try to feel the essence of life through the depth of life, through the bottom of life, through that, the reality. You know, they want to feel things. And their connection to happiness comes in a feeling state, a feeling of especially connection. So these are just four. But notice in all four, it's an essence. There's a thing. You know, there's a...
I'm thinking about the fifth, Armand, and I can think of a physicist who is definitely a five, and he's happy with very little. He lives in almost at the level of poverty. He spends very little money. He earns very little money because he doesn't want to work too much because he wants to read all the time. And he's happy when he can study and learn and think. That's his happiness.
And there is this type. This is the type that tends to be isolated. They tend to be suspicious. You know, they're observers. They watch everything and they have hobbies. And what you would do, and I mean, I've had hobbies in my life. This is the kind of person who might collect bottle caps, you know. And then one day they'll find a bottle cap from the year 1845, and they will feel so much joy as they bring that bottle cap to their collection. Because they study the nuance of everything. They could be wine people. They could study about wine. These are
which, you know, it gives me a chance to put in my two cents here, that in happiness what has been found is that there is a biological component, there is a learned component, and there is a cognitive component. And all three of those seem to be important for the state of happiness to be complete. The biological component, of course, is the neurotransmitters, is the brain, it's the nervous system, is the feeling of being happy. The learned component is that when you've learned that something makes you happy, if you've learned that reading certain things make you happy, then every time you read certain things, you reinforce that behavior and you reinforce the pleasure that you experience when you engage in it. And then the third component, the cognitive component, means that there's a thought process that goes on with being happy that, you know, is an important aspect of it as well. And as Armand is describing the nine types of the Enneagram, I'm looking at all of them and they all have different biological strata of neurotransmitters, you know, because someone could feel really good with an excess of dopamine. For someone else, that could be hell. That could make them feel really uncomfortable. And what they need really is an excess of serotonin. And, you know, I think everyone has a different biological, physiological biochemistry that they call being happy. And everyone has a different learned response to being happy. Someone could have learned to be happy when they feel humiliated, as you were pointing out the other day, Armand. Someone could have learned that when they're humiliated, that's when they're loved. So that could feel happy. And the thinking, that's the trickiest one.
Well, let's get into the thinking types. The number six type is called a loyalist. But, you know, here's a person who basically feels connected, very connected to another person. Like, they'll generally be the kind of person who would be a follower rather than a leader. If their leader has success, the loyalist will have, like, they'll work on a presidential campaign. And if the president wins, they're happy for a short period of time. But they also have a tremendous fear component. They're very afraid. So feeling safety makes them feel happy. But this is a very big difficulty for this type of personality because they never really get to that safety like the perfectionist. never gets to the perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Then comes the seven, the epicure. Person who likes a taste of everything. He wants to have as many different things, as many different lovers, as many different pies as possible. And what makes this person feel happy is variation. And now this goes a little to what you were saying, freedom. Freedom is the claim of the seven. The seven says, give me freedom or give me death. I must be able to spread my wings. The worst thing in the world I could do is to be tied down. Well, to some other people, being tied down is not a... Let's not question whether or not you have freedom. There are people who have been slaves who were able to be happy.
Sure.
So now comes the eight, who is the controlling boss type. To them, exercising complete control and having an effective control and feeling like they're in control is what makes them happy.
Mm-hmm.
And the last is the nine. The nine is a person who must quell anger. They must control anger. And I mean, this is in a lot of cultures, this is very strong. They've got to keep people.
The peacemaker. Peacemaker,
yeah.
Right.
So their happiness is when everything is peaceful.
Mm-hmm.
But you see, if a nine tries to tell an eight how to live and how to be happy, they're going to be so wrong because.
Well, they're so different.
The eight lives on anger,
mm-hmm.
right? And aggression. It's kind of easy. The more aggressive I am, I could hum with aggression. That's what the eight does. The nine says, calm it down.
It's dangerous.
Don't get out of control. Boy, right. If we can make everybody be peaceful. I've known a couple of people recently, my friends, who were in a recent, very recent, in fact, very currently active struggle. That's going on at this organization that I know. And in this organization, everybody's trying to calm everybody down. And they're in the middle of a major chaos. I mean, there's people in this organization who hate each other. And they, I'm going to kill that person. And there's the other people who are the managers who are saying, no, we got to calm it down. Let's be reasonable. Well, you see, my trouble with it is nobody's going to be happy by making it reasonable. You may as well let it blow up and then see what exists after you let it blow up. Because trying to calm all of the emotions all the time, which is what nines do, is eventually makes it break out. It's like an addiction. You know, if you control an addiction, the addiction comes out somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. Well, as far as happiness is concerned, Armand, the latest research shows something really interesting. When they took women, men, even adolescents, and asked them to imagine laughter or to imagine sadness, just to imagine those emotions, it turns out that they were able to bring themselves to activate the brain as if the brain was experiencing happiness just from imagining laughter, imagining the motion involved in laughter, imagining the motion of the belly, of the muscles in around the lungs, of the face. So there's something to be said about imagining whatever makes us happy that could be a good idea. At least in the research, it shows that whatever makes you happy, whatever that is, whether you're an eight or a two or a five, whatever makes you tick, if you are able to imagine it, even if you don't have it, but you bring it up into your mind as if it were real, your neurological system will respond with the same intensity, activity, as if it were real. So that's important, I think, Armand.
Well, I think it is important, but you know, what you're really talking about is fantasy. What you're saying is fantasize it, and that will bring up the feeling, which it does. So you lay in your bed and you fantasize making love to Tom Cruise.
Tom Cruise?
He's an actor.
I know. I was trying to figure out why the choice. But anyway,
I was just trying to put images in people's head because a lot of people lay in bed and imagine making love to Tom Cruise, you know,
yeah.
And or Vivica Linford. I don't know, somebody else. So let's say that you imagine having sex or making love or doing something like that, and you fantasize and even take it to an erotic satisfaction.
How about imagining that you're flying?
Or imagining you fly. Again, there's your freedom thing, you see. Mm. You see, you're winged victory over there.
Well, Roberta, I'd love to imagine
you
that.
See, you see, it's freedom for you. Mm. Wherever you imagine freedom, you imagine happiness.
That's what works
because
for me.
Because you are a force of nature.
from Bologna.
From Bologna.
What works for me is, yes, an image of freedom or an image of space. But whatever person is able to imagine, but what the research shows is it's not just imagining the abstract idea of it. Really imagine the details. Imagine yourself in the situation, moving the body in the way that fits the situation. Like if I'm imagining that I'm flying, I imagine my wings flapping. I imagine the wind on my face. I imagine seeing a panoramic view of the horizon. I imagine as many details of it as I can. And that's true for all of these different experiences of happiness. We can fantasize, as Armand says, and be able to train the brain to experience more happiness.
See, that's the theory.
I know you disagree. Okay.
See, no, I don't disagree.
That's what the research shows.
That's what the research
is. It may be an oversimplification.
Whenever you have research, like neuroscience, you're going to find some kind of simplistic solution.
True.
Like they did it with biofeedback. You know, if only we can get you to breathe in a certain way, and then we get you to meditate, and
well,
then you quiet your mind.
And it makes the
but it also
happy.
Is a good idea. Maybe that'll work. And I'm saying, oh, sure, it's a good theory. What we've got is neuroscience, which is an imaging method of being able to understand. And what you've got to do when you want to sell the product is you've got to come up with a solution. And I'm stuck on the solutions because I've known people who have tried to imagine happiness for a long time, and they imagine it for a little time, and then they come out of it, and they don't necessarily get any better.
Maybe, Armand, we should say something about the expectation of happiness. It seems that, and this again could be a cliche, the more we expect it, the more elusive it is, because happiness is like a treadmill. It's something that we run on, we don't stay on. We keep running to feel better than we're feeling in the moment, because that's how we're programmed to be. It's programmed into us to constantly be looking for what feels good. And whatever that might be, which could be the opposite for me than what it is for you. But yes, we're programmed never to be satisfied with what we have in this moment. Even if we have what we wanted 5 minutes ago, that sense of satisfaction is going to last a period of time, and then it's going to cease, and we need something else.
It's like Chinese food.
It's like Chinese mm-hmm. food. It's like an addiction in a way. So could we say then that maybe the expectation of happiness could be a setup?
I'm sure it is. We're learning more. You know, there's a lot of expectations of love may be a setup. Expectations of a lot of things may be a setup, and thank God all of our beliefs are breaking down a little bit. And here's the only problem, friends. When your beliefs break down, don't think you've got to find a solution. Let your beliefs break down, and this is a solution, and I'm offering a solution. If you let your beliefs break down, watch what forms from there. So I'm offering another theory about a possible path to happiness. But wait, before we go, we have
valid.
To answer the question.
What question?
This is the most ridiculous thing that they found out in the research science about who's happiest.
What is that, Armand?
People 42 years old.
Oh, yes.
Gee.
You would think that these are people who are in the middle of the midlife crisis, right? If they're given, if you give a rating between 0 and 10, 0 being the least happy, 10 being the happiest, people around 42 years of age are those who tend to rate themselves at 10 more consistently than anybody else.
So 42 is the age to look forward to if you're down there. You know, but if you're up there.
Up where?
Well, if you're above 42.
Oh, I see.
What do you do? Look to 84. Because
there you go. That could be.
Double it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
mm-hmm.
We're getting silly. Hey, this is Armando with Roberta Maria Atti. Hope you've enjoyed this little exploration. Do stay tuned, very closely attending to the dynamics of our radio station.
Yes, do.
Which
do.
Are about yes. to go through the most intriguing transformations, my friends. But we will be with you. Roberta Maria Atti on her way to Bologna.
I'm leaving this afternoon.
You're yes, going. You'll
I'm
be back
going.
In 2 weeks.
I'm going to be back in 2 weeks, yes.
We will miss you.
And I will miss you. But I will be listening because, of course, I listen to WBI wherever I go.
Be back with you then. My friends, if you want to listen to today's program, as soon as somebody sends me a copy, you go to thepositivemind.com, www.thepositivemind.com. Roberta's website?
Website is www.creativehealthsolutions.org.
CreativeHealthSolutions.org or thepositivemind.com. This is Armand DeMille, back with you tomorrow around one-ish.